Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. It's Oscar season, and as we've done in the past, we're going to focus our coverage on this show on all five nominees for Best Feature-Length Documentary. We'll do two of them back-to-back right now. Later this hour, we'll be talking to director Ezra Edelman about his Oscar-nominated documentary, the 8-hour-long film O.J. Made in America, that aired as an ESPN series. But first, to kick off our series on the feature-length documentaries, I'm so thrilled to have back with us CNN host and commentator Van Jones, who's representing filmmaker Ava DuVernay, nominated for the film 13th about mass incarceration in America. Van, great to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
It's an honor to be here, always.
And I'll start with a clip from the film, which explains a little bit about how the 13th Amendment in the Constitution, despite abolishing slavery, contains a loophole that has created the nation's current prison system, which disproportionately affects black Americans.
The 13th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. In other words, it grants freedom to all Americans. There are exceptions, including criminals.
There's a clause, a loophole.
If you have that embedded in the structure, in this constitutional language, then it's there to be used as a tool for whichever purposes one wants to use it.
So, Van, you want to elaborate on that right from the start? It sounds like, it might sound to people on its face like, yeah, of course, you know, freedom for everybody. Unless you're a criminal, then you can be incarcerated.
Well, I think that, first of all, I just want to say about this documentary, if you haven't seen it, it's really a powerful, powerful statement. And I think we recognize kind of in the back of our mind, yeah, it seems like a lot of people are in prison and maybe there's some racial things going on. But it's when you put it all together, all these little dots that have never really been connected in cinema before, it really hits home. And of course, people do bad stuff, you want to have consequences and that kind of thing. But the kinds of the way that the particular prison system developed in the United States, as opposed to other countries where people, you know, are not brutalized, they aren't in solitary confinement, they aren't given 20, 30-year sentences for minor drug offenses, they aren't subjected to rape, they aren't stripped of all their voting rights and their right to get even a student loan or apartment. Other countries do it differently. Why do we do it in such a barbaric way, and why do we do it in a way that has such a massively disproportionate impact on African Americans? African Americans use illegal drugs at exactly the same rate as white people, but we are 60% more likely. No, not 60%. Six times more likely to wind up in prison. This documentary really gets into that.
One of the things that broke out as a conversation when it first came out was around that language of slavery and a loophole in the 13th Amendment regarding people who are imprisoned, that slave labor, I should say prison labor itself, became the issue. Forced labor as a form of slavery of people who committed whatever crime got them behind bars. But people should realize, and I think you were getting at this, it's really much broader than that, this film, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I call it the incarceration industry now. People talk about mass incarceration. I talk about also the incarceration industry. It's an $80 billion a year industry, trafficking in human flesh. You have private for-profit prisons, but even the public prisons are massive profit centers, especially in often rural prison towns. You have prison guards unions that are in the game trying to drive up the sentences so they have more members and higher salaries. And there's just basically a profit motive alongside of a racial bias has completely warped what should be a criminal justice system and turned it into an incarceration industry.
And listeners, if you want to talk to Van Jones today about 13th, if you've seen it, or even if you haven't, or about the news, you know, he's been, you know, very prominent on CNN during the election campaign and since the election. You could talk about the film. You can talk about other things in The Nation, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And this isn't the only place where you've been out in the media representing Ava DuVernay. What's your connection to the film?
Well, I'm in the film. That's always a good thing. But I'm also just a huge fan of Ava's and have become a friend of hers by working on the film. And she's just one of the most extraordinary directors in the world. Her sensibility about how to tell these very, very tough stories in a way that, you know, it's heartbreaking, but it's the kind of film I think everyone should see. Because even if you don't agree with everything in the film, it's a perspective. And it's a perspective that really animates the Black Lives Matter movement and so much of African American politics. If you want to, you know, take an hour and figure out what the heck is going on, why are these people protesting, it is the best cinematic representation of that point of view.
And part of the focus is on the 1970s, when we really begin to see this era of what we now refer to as mass incarceration. For people who weren't alive at that time or don't know the history, what was going on, particularly in the 1970s?
Well, in the 1970s, you had, on the one hand, the civil rights and black power movements were beginning to wane in some ways because law enforcement really went after those groups, often wrongfully targeting leaders, et cetera. But also you began to see the expansion of the prison system. And as you get into the 80s and the 90s, the idea of, you know, lock them up and throw away the key, building prisons everywhere, both parties coming around to this view that the best response to drug abuse was a draconian attack on communities as opposed to public health assistance. You know, the difference between what you see with opioids now versus crack in the 80s is 100%, you know, 180 degree difference. Zero compassion, all militarization. You're not seeing SWAT teams kick in the door at, you know, CVS and, you know, arrest people for pushing opioids. You're not seeing mass arrests in rural America for using heroin. But you did see, when you had African Americans with an addiction crisis, a real draconian approach. And this film links that back to other eras where African American people, black bodies, as they now say, were subjected to horrific violence, and the film very powerful in connecting those dots.
You've been quoted saying the history reflected in this film contributed pretty directly to the election of Donald Trump, mm-hmm. which is not a case that the film itself is trying to make, but do you think so?
Well, absolutely. In other words, I think people say, oh, well, you know, mass incarceration, that's an issue basically for black people. And what people don't understand is, if you didn't have, I think, almost 25% of the African-American male population in Florida disenfranchised and unable to vote, Florida would be a blue state every time. I think Georgia would also be a blue state or would be very close to being a blue state if you didn't have both incredibly disproportionate incarceration for African-Americans. I didn't say disproportionate criminal activity. People say, oh, well, if black people would stop committing crimes, they wouldn't go to prison. No. White people commit crimes and they don't go to prison. Any of these campuses around here this weekend, there's going to be a lot of drugs done and a lot of drugs dealt. None of those students are going to prison. A few blocks away in the housing projects, all those kids would go to prison. So what we have is we've looked the other way for so long that we've now, the democracy is suffering because so many African Americans are not able to vote, and that allowed Trump to win in Georgia and Florida. If you don't like Donald Trump, start fighting against mass incarceration.
And I think exactly on that point, Tara in Dutchess County, you're on WNYC with Van Jones. Hi, Tara.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Van, I'm a member of your Love Army.
Yay.
My question is regarding the restoration of voting rights to those who've been incarcerated. I've long thought it was an abomination that if you've been rehabilitated, you can't participate in our democracy. My question is, where is any activism or legislation taking foot that I can support or get involved in to help turn this around?
Well, you know, the good thing is that there are a lot of states, I believe New York and California are two of them, where this fight has been fought and won, and where once you are off parole, you are able to vote again, and a lot of people don't know that. And so I do want to make sure that most of the people under the sound of our voice actually can have their rights restored. The problem is we've got a bunch of big states, including Florida, Texas, and others, where that is simply not the case. And so there are, you know, I'm a part of an organization also called Cut 50, hashtag cut as in scissors, cut 50, 50, .org. So cut50.org is working to cut the prison population in half. If you want to go to cut50.org, you can sign up. We need all the help we can get.
And what would be the biggest one or two things to cut the prison population in half?
Well, first of all, it would be to treat addiction as a public health issue and not a criminal issue. Criminalizing addiction is one of the worst things that you can do. It increases the stigma. It's very hard to go through recovery if you're in prison or if you're afraid you might go to prison. And it doesn't work. And in other countries, they just take a completely different approach. And it works out much better. That would be important, reforming the drug laws. But the other thing I think is really important is that at a level of public consciousness, it's not just the incarceration. It's what I would call the criminalization, the idea that when you see a young African-American, the first neuron that fires is a fear or a concern that this person might be a threat to me. And pushing back on that, more humanizing narratives. The opposite of criminalization is humanization. Beginning to show in all of our professions, when we have the opportunity to make hires, to tell stories, to make decisions, to do all we can to humanize people and not criminalize people.
Do you think that, ironically, the opioid epidemic now in white, rural, and suburban America might actually help reverse mass incarceration of African Americans? Because we know that when things happen to white people or when white people do things in large numbers that, you know, are not good, we ask ourselves as a nation, what's wrong with our society? Well, how are we failing our children?
Yeah.
And when black people, we say, why are they super predators?
Exactly.
We have to
what's
lock
wrong with them?
So is there actually a political opportunity opened up by the sad fact of the opioid epidemic?
Well, I think so. We have to compassion, once it gets going, doesn't have to stop at a particular community or even a particular issue. You know, Prince, the late rock star, I was very close to him. He died from opioid addiction and abuse, and we didn't even have any idea what was going on until right at the very end, because people hide and they're so ashamed. They have so much stigma. He was taking pills the doctor gave him for his hip pain, like a lot of people, and he got hooked, and that's happening across the country. And then people try to withdraw on their own with no help, and then they overdose and they die. So my point is simply this. The obvious comparison of the compassion that's being shown, especially within the Republican Party, for people who are addicted to opioids, gives us a place to stand to say, why don't we just rethink this whole thing? If we're going to treat opioid addiction data-driven and compassionately, let's treat heroin, which goes right along with that, and cocaine and all the other stuff, data-driven, compassionate, effective, and let's stand together to do it. I think there is an opportunity here.
Van Jones, my guest on WNYC, here representing the filmmaker Ava DuVernay and her Oscar-nominated documentary, 13th. It's the first in the series of interviews we do every year around Oscar time, where we talk to people associated with the five films nominated for Best Feature-Length Documentary. That's how geeky we are. Gordon on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC with Van Jones. Hi, Gordon.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Glad you're in.
Hi, Van. I'm a huge fan. And
thank you, brother.
Thank you so much for your work. my question is, considering how racism is systemic and adapts, and if prison reform does take hold and there are less incarceration rates for the population, how do you feel about the increasing criminalization of immigrants? Arrests for petty crimes and felony crimes, and the indeterminate incarceration while awaiting deportation. Is that the new way racism is going to take effect with the prison population?
You know, there's a huge danger of that, and frankly, it's already underway. First of all, you could be in the worst of all possible worlds where you have growing detention centers and all the things that are happening right now with this awful attack that's going down, frankly, very underreported. But you know, there's a wave of fear going through immigrant communities all across the country right now, this morning, people waking up because Donald Trump is sicking law enforcement on communities that are peaceful, that they're not doing anything wrong. They're adding to the GDP, the GNP, and every other P, and yet they are now under this assault. So we have to recognize that there's a tendency sometimes for state violence. You know, that's kind of a human rights term, but a kind of violence from the government inside the U.S. borders, which usually looks like mass incarceration, police brutality, at the U.S. border, which looks like you know, excessive deportations and deportation centers. And then even beyond the U.S. borders, when you're talking about the drone strikes, et cetera, there's almost a seamless web of violence that seems to be directed at people of color. And it is one of those, you know, sad, shocking, shameful facts about the way that the country is still operating. You know, films like The 13th shed light on part of it, but there's so much more to be told. And I do think the situation for immigrants in this country, Muslims in this country, and frankly, Muslims beyond the border is something I would love to see Ava do some documentaries about that too.
The film continuously comes back to how black people are portrayed as criminals in the media through a combination of more than a dozen interviews in the film with figures like Senator Cory Booker and activist Angela Davis, and through carefully cut archival footage. One moment that resonates today is from 1989, when one Donald Trump took a very public stance to lock up the teenagers in the Central Park jogger case.
You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it.
Donald Trump wanted to give these kids a death penalty, and he took out a full-page ad to put the pressure on. These children, four of them under 18, all went to adult prisons for 6 to 11 years before DNA evidence proved they were all innocent.
And that second voice was Malkia Cyril from the Center for Media Justice in the film 13th. And I guess the more recent news is that Donald Trump never really accepted the finding, apparently, of the DA's office that those kids were wrongly convicted.
You know, it was one of those things that he said during the campaign, in the middle of saying 20 other crazy things, you know, that hour, that really never got enough attention. But you basically have someone who says he believes tabloid newspaper reports over DNA evidence when it comes to black criminality. And there were just so many terrible things that he said that never got lifted up. But, you know, when you have someone like that who then puts Bannon in the White House with his ties to white supremacists, and then who puts Jeffrey Sessions over Department of Justice with the grave concerns that the civil rights community was raising about him, you know, there's a lot of reason to be concerned.
Now, you've been doing your series on CNN, The Messy Truth, which seeks to get pro and anti-Trump America to listen to and understand each other a little better. Considering what you just said and how much distrust African-Americans, among other people who are afraid of Trump, must see a lot of Trump voters who they don't know, is it possible to accomplish that?
It is and it isn't. It's messy. That's why we call it the messy truth. There's not one Trump voter. There's 60-plus million Trump voters. Some of them are hardened white nationalists, but it's a relatively small number. They get a lot of attention. Those people I don't think are going to be reachable. Some were, they don't agree with all that alt-right stuff, but they kind of liked the attitude of a Trump. They liked that he was stirring the pot, that he was willing to say what he thought, and he was willing to kind of, you know, throw conventional wisdom to the wind. And then there were some Trump voters, and those are the ones that I'm most interested in, that were actually, they found his comments distasteful, disgraceful, but not disqualifying, because they had other concerns, whether it was, you know, reproductive choice in the Supreme Court, or whether it was, you know, jobs in the Rust Belt, or the coal industry going under, and they chose to essentially hold their nose and vote for someone who said things that for us as liberals completely disqualifying. For them, distasteful, but not disqualifying. And that's where I think there's opportunity for real dialogue.
Do you think you're breaking through the echo chambers? Any stories to tell of that happening?
Well, you know, one can always hope and dream. I can tell you that going to Pennsylvania, going to West Virginia, sitting in living rooms and cafes, knee to knee sometimes with folks who voted for Trump, and recognizing, some of these Trump voters are just terrific human beings, just unbelievably good, decent people, very, very, it's almost insulting to say very educated. I don't mean to pretend that, that you should think any other thing about them, but I mean deeply read people, but just see the world differently, have different news sources, different concerns. And many of them would be very, very opposed to a Muslim registry, for instance. Many, especially the veterans, they say, well, I didn't go fight for that. One of them in West Virginia said, if they start putting those Muslims on trains, I'm going to go get my gun and stop them. Saying that about Trump is a Trump voter and a hardcore Trump voter. So it's messy. And that's why we call the show The Messy Truth. It's not these easy polarities. I think sometimes liberals like to imagine these easy polarities. It's just easier to be mad than to try to figure out what the heck is going on.
I don't know if there are enough people like this to make a difference, but when the travel ban was announced and there was that spontaneous demonstration at Kennedy Airport, as well as airports around the country, I saw on TV one of the interviews of one of the demonstrators who showed up said, listen, I'm for Trump. I voted for Trump. I think we have to give Trump a chance. He could be a really good president, but I don't like this.
Exactly. And I think that we should be much – listen, progressives and those who oppose Trump's agenda should be more aggressive. We should be some of this stuff is completely outrageous, and the stuff that's completely outrageous we should take the hardest stand possible against. And we should be very tough on Trump. But I think Trump is much worse than most liberals ever could imagine. Even in our most hysterical moments in the campaign, he's much worse. But I think a lot of his supporters are much better than we fear. And the hope comes from the fact that there are people who voted for Trump who, on specific issues and policies, will stand with us. And we can't just push them all away, say they're all ignorant bigots and we hate them all, because you're just giving him people he doesn't deserve.
Seth in Fort Myers, Florida. You're on WNYC with Van Jones. Hi, Seth.
Hey, how are you, Brian?
Good. I couldn't get you Seth Myers, so I got you Seth in Fort Myers. Hey,
exactly. That's close enough.
Go
maybe,
ahead.
Maybe even better. Maybe better.
Go ahead, Seth.
Hey, Van. Very, very big fan of you. Was actually just watching YouTube videos like one after the other night of just people that you had on and stuff. So pretty excited to be talking to you.
Thank you.
My question is, okay, so I'm 22 years old, white kid, grew up in Florida, and I'm actually in New York for work right now. But I started this job, and one of my colleagues, his name is Shai, he's black and Puerto Rican, and we really hit it off. You know, we're both the same age, you know, just hanging out and everything and working. But we ended up talking about the documentary 13th, which I just watched it probably about 4 or 5 months ago. And we were talking about it, and from that, you know, obviously the conversation progressed. And what I came to realize during our conversations about it was, you know, not only was I enraged when I watched it first and foremost, and I thought, I can't even imagine what it would feel like to be a person of color, of any minority, to watch this, especially the fact that I think that what I realized from Shai was a lot of people in minorities grow up with that being common knowledge of their household. You know,
right,
so
right.
When it comes to white America, and obviously
in the process of getting woke.
But you know, I grew up never hearing any of that. I had no idea. And I think that, you know, when I realized that, you know, you always try to, and I've always tried to, you know, try to bridge that gap, especially with the tensions heating up as I'm growing up and getting older and becoming
and
a little
Seth,
more.
And Seth, forgive me, but for time, what's your question for Van?
True Southern. True Southern.
I was just getting to. Sorry about that, Brian. My question is, you know, how people want us to use the white privilege, which I completely acknowledge, to help to bridge that gap. And sometimes it almost feels condescending, like I'm up here and I'm going to step in and be like, hey, I got this. You know what I mean? I don't. And a lot of the time I feel like that help isn't wanted from a minority, you know, so I just don't really know sometimes how to make that connection. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. This is very difficult, and any one interaction, you may feel that you were, you know, you came on too strong, or you didn't come on strong enough, or you strained the relationship, or that's just living in this toxic stew of all of these isms and bigotries and biases and challenges and blind spots and sore spots. So I'm sure you're doing the best that you can, and you'll do better over time. I want to focus us, though, on some of the structural changes as well. We need to be organizing, and we need to be putting pressure on governments and corporations to act differently. I was talking to somebody who pointed out that there are a number of community banks that are actually run by African Americans that have very, very small deposits. I said, well, geez, we have all these white progressive organizations. Some of them have $100 million budgets. Why don't we ask those organizations to put some of their money in these community banks? It's FDIC insured. They're not going to lose a penny. But then suddenly you have community banks that can have real capital. They can loan out and help some of these businesses grow. Let's start using the resources that we have institutionally to get liberal organizations to do better, to hire better, to invest better. The individual conversations, any individual conversation can be good or bad on any topic. I don't think we should judge ourselves so much on that as what are we doing to make the institutions that we're a part of better allies to communities that are struggling.
We just have about a minute or so left, and then we're going to go on to our next director of an Oscar-nominated documentary, Ezra Edelman, who did O.J. Made in America.
That's our toughest competition, so I hope that they don't do good.
Well, I actually had the thought that maybe the two criminal justice system and race documentaries that are nominated could win a joint award.
That would be very nice, except I think Ava wants the award.
So for you representing Ava and the film, first of all, I want people to know that Netflix has recently granted permission for the documentary to be shown in schools free of charge.
Yeah, which is amazing. Really, really good.
So really, really good. So just any teachers who are listening and people who have that kind of connection, you should know that that's available to you because it should be seen. And what would it mean to the movement, to the cause, to win the Oscar? Anything?
I think it would be a big validation because – you have a number of movements in the country that are vitally important. What's happening at Standing Rock right now, vitally important. The fight for Muslims, vitally important. The transgender fight, vitally important. This renewed women's march and this kind of, feminism 3.0, 9.0, I don't know what it is. You walk down the list, what's going on with the Dreamers and the immigrants. So all these fights are important. This fight against mass incarceration, I think, is also very important. And if it could be if the best cinematic expression of this ever could be honored by the biggest award ever, I think it would give a lot of hope and a lot of help to people.
Van Jones, thank you so much. Be watching you on CNN.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And yes, Ezra Edelman, director of O.J. Made in America, next.